So now, please welcome Maria Spiropoulou, who will discuss the state of particle physics today. Maria?
Well, that was a very interesting introduction for me, all this hour, Niels and the panel. I'm going to be talking today about convergence in particle physics, and I'm going to be circling around the themes that you've heard already. In other words, the small, the large, and perhaps tools in between, including new methods in order to accelerate to the highest energy possible. And the convergence in this case, what I'm talking about convergence is not the superstars of all these experiments coming together, but I'm rather talking about having all views and experimentalists and theorists having conflicting views in many cases, because we have challenges and struggles, and because we are talking about a lot of simplicity from the theoretical point of view, and in fact, from the experimental point of view, there is a lot of complexity, as I will try to illustrate. Well, I don't want to forget that a couple of weeks ago, on June 3rd, we had, in fact, the first Large Hadron Collider collisions. I call the previous ones the Little Hadron Collider collisions, because they were about half the energy, 7 or 8 TeV, and right now we achieved 13 TeV. You may remember that the original specification of this collider was 14 TeV, so we're getting close to the original design, and the reason why we have not achieved it has to do with the magnets. If anyone wants to know the story, I can tell you later. What you see in this view graph is the two panels from the what we call LHC page one, from the operations of the LHC, where we arrived at the integrated luminosity and the 6.5 the energy, which is 6.5 TeV per beam here. So that is the new era of the Large Hadron Collider indeed. And here you see one of the first events that we recorded in one of the detectors. This is the compact muon solenoid detector. Neil showed you the ATLAS detector before, and we're going to see a few displays from both of these detectors. So that looks complex to me, and so we, in order to arrive to any result which gives you something about the reality of nature, there is a lot of complexity in the data and in the analysis that that is involved. Now, I have these four little pictures that were the result of the P5 Building for Discovery panel of the Department of Energy in the United States. Similar reviews and analysis has been done in Europe for how we are going to build tools for discovery in the future and where are the directions and the priorities in this field. So the first one on the left, which we have just discovered, is the Higgs boson, the H boson, and the idea is to use now the Higgs, the discovered Higgs, as a tool for further discovery, and that we call beyond the Higgs and beyond the standard model discoveries. The second little graph represents pursuing the physics of the mass of the neutrinos. You heard before that Natalia mentioned before that neutrinos have mass, and this is very important. In fact, everything that we have predicted about neutrinos ever was experimentally proven to be wrong, and those little particles present perhaps the highest content of particles compared to any other particle that we have in the universe. So the third one, you heard a lot about the third one, is the dark matter, is exploring what kind of new physics is the physics of dark matter. You have heard in the panel, and you hear it a lot, that dark matter could be one particle, many particles. There can be a whole new dark sector and a whole new dark universe there. And the fact of the matter is that about dark matter, we have observations. We know it's gravitationally interacting and nothing else. And whether it is a particle or a cloud or something, we don't know what it is. The only thing we know is that it has to do with gravity. Dark energy, so this is about the cosmic acceleration, and this is part of the discussion we heard before about the edges of the universe. The universe is, the interpretation of the data we have for the universe is that the universe is accelerating, and so you've got little cubic centimeters of space-time at the edges of the universe, and this we need to study and to understand. It has to do with, it has to do, again, in a very interesting way with gravity. So two of those five squares there have to do with gravity. Higgs has to do with the electroweak symmetry breaking and giving mass to the particles, as you know. And neutrinos, having mass, became an issue for physics. So you see that there is a lot of aspects in particle physics, and they all have some connections. And therein lies the convergence of perhaps a wishful thinking that maybe this is all connected. Now, the last one is connected with every other one, and it's called exploring the unknown. Well, I think exploring the unknown is in all of the previous four. And this is how the future of particle physics and its convergence or consilience or connections with the cosmology come together in this drafting report. Now, I wanted to show you the face of particle physics, the face of this is some of the students from the Caltech group, which is at CMS, but this is the say faces from all the universities and all the places in the world. They look very similar, and they are the young people that are actually operating the experiment, taking the data, making the analysis, from the ages of sophomores at least, all the way to postdocs and senior people. This is people that are that live in Geneva or at Fermilab or at their home institution. So this is a very rich program that involves many places and many nationalities. I want to say one thing that was in the news very recently, and I was glad to be invited to this. There is for the first time there is a bilateral agreement between CERN and the Department of Energy and the National Science Foundation. So United States, on May 7th, there was a signing of the cooperation agreement between CERN and NSF DOE. And in this agreement, the difference compared to what it used to be is that now CERN is investing in the physics, in particle physics in America. And while before it was always the US was investing at CERN. This is significant because it shows you also that just as CERN, through a political will, undertook a massive experimental physics program after the end of the war in order to unite Europe. In the same way, there is similar political will by the nations and by countries and by people, essentially, wanting to continue this type of research. In the picture, you see Ernie Moniz and Joe Handelsman from OSTP. Ernie Moniz is the head of the DOE. You see the director, Rolf Hoyer, who looks like God. And you see Franz Cordova, who is the head of the National Science Foundation. So I will go very briefly to talk about the standard theory of particles and forces. I am pretty sure you have seen this kind of introduction before, so I will try to be as to the point as possible. And I want to thank Freddy because he explained everything about quantum field theory, so now you are trained. It's a framework, and it's a language, in particular, in our case, that for particle physics and condensed matter physics, that describes pretty much everything. In the stump that you see there, you see Feynman, and what you see is little diagrams. So the mathematical framework there is that every line, every wiggle, and every point is a mathematical, has a mathematical expression for how strong an interaction is, and the couplings, and how what is the rate of these type of processes, and which particles go in, which particles go out. Now, this is the blueprint of the universe, for the universe. Neil showed the similar equations from the Schrödinger equation. This is just the Lagrangian of the standard model. The phi is the Higgs in there, and it shows you how everybody couples with everybody else in the content of the particles. You need to have the language, the quantum field theory language, in order to go through this. So I'm just going to show, I'm showing it to you as a mathematical representation. In fact, at the discovery of the Higgs, my friend David Gross, when we discussed about it, he said, "Of course, it's a triumph for mathematics." He said, on the right side, you see the particles of the standard model. You see on the top block the UD, CS, TB. These are the quarks: up, down, charm, strange, top, bottom. And you see on the bottom the green ones, these are the leptons, all of the top and the bottom blocks, so the neutrinos, the electrons, the muon, the tau, the entire block of green and lila on the top, they are fermions, and fermions have spin 1/2. And let me do the Feynman exhibit here of what spin 1/2 is, but I promised also Neil that I will dance, so here it is. I'm looking at you. If I do, and that's dangerous now, if I do a pirouette, 360, okay, that's the dance. I see you again. I see exactly where I start from. However, if I take a system, which is my hand and a glass of water, and I try to do with the system remaining as is, and I try to do a 360, something is wrong. I don't go where I started from. I need to do yet another 360 before I arrive to where I should be. So in the quantum world, this is called spin 1/2. The system is spin 1/2. When it turns 360, it acquires a phase. Thank you. So... So on the right hand side we have the forces, and these are the bosons. All those guys there, the red ones, they have, as you can see, if you're looking very carefully and you're reading the slide, they have spin 1. All of them have spin 1. All of those big on the big block have 1/2. They are fermions. All of those have spin 1. They are bosons. Well, the best realization of supersymmetry in nature would have been if the fermions were the partners of the bosons, we would be done and go home and supersymmetry would be true. Of course, it's not the case because of quantum mechanics and the other properties. And this is why we're looking for every single one of these to have a partner. We're going to talk about supersymmetry later and the frustration that we share with Natalia. There's one boson missing there. There's one boson missing. There is a boson that we discovered, and it's unlike any other boson. We discovered it in July. We announced it in July 2012. It's the Higgs boson. It's the H boson, and it has spin 0. It's the only, we think, elementary particle with spin 0, at least so far. So here we are. I showed them to you in a nice tabular form where everybody looked the same as everybody else. In fact, if you look at the masses of these particles, both the leptons and the quarks, the way they scale is completely schizophrenic. There is no pattern. Some people try to find patterns and logarithmic patterns. These electron neutrinos, and the neutrinos, we said they're close to zero, very small masses. And these on the quarks, the largest of the quarks is the top quarks, huge mass, hierarchies of in between the scales in the electroweak scale. In fact, we are observing them in the masses. We don't know. We don't know why we have all these particles. We don't know where they're coming from. We don't know why they have those different flavors. And for the bosons, we have those two, three photon W and Z. Those are actually, one could say, they have been the quantum phases of the Higgs. So these are the, when electroweak symmetry breaking happens, those three emerge, and they merge with the masses that they have, namely photon equals zero, the W and the Z is about 100 GeV, close to the Higgs, which is 125, as we found. And then we've got quantum chromodynamics. This describes everything that has to do with the interactions in protons and neutrons and all the particles that have quarks. And as we mentioned before, those have the spin 1/2, those have the spin 1. And in order to study all these, we have an accelerator for discovery, accelerators for discovery program since it's about 70 years. And I include in the 70 years, not only the accelerators, but the cosmic accelerators, I include cosmic rays. The first accelerator that gave us particles, high energy particles, were cosmic rays. This is where this field comes from. And then we have developed all of these machines. And I have in this picture, there's Fermilab there, there is the Cockcroft and Walton at Fermilab, there is the LHC here, there is machines at Brookhaven, the first 11-inch cyclotron. And then I have a little one here, a little accelerator that it is, I found out that they have it in Louvre, and they do on the spot measurements of the different paintings there, and they do do the timing of the painting, when it was the chronology of the painting. So this I just wanted to show you a little bit about my trajectory. I started in a nuclear lab in Greece, in the Aristotle University of Thessaloniki. We didn't have pictures there. And then I went to CERN and Berlin. I worked in a synchrotron lab first, and then I worked as a particle physicist. I moved then to do my PhD at the Tevatron about 20 years ago in Batavia, Illinois. This was where the hydrogen bottle is, where you start the collision, you start making protons at the lab. And then after the Tevatron, where I spent about 11 years, I moved to the LHC. So one of the same, except bigger. And you see these pictures are here from the CMS when it was at the time that it was being built. This was at Fermilab. This is at the LHC with the dipole magnets. These are the 14-meter magnets that are the core and the power of the LHC that can keep the beams of the protons bent in the 27-kilometer tunnel. So, in recapitulating a little bit about what we said about the elementary particles, the standard model, the full standard model formulated in 1967, in this model, the particles do not naturally have mass, they are all zero mass, and they acquire mass through dynamics. For gauge bosons, for the W and the Z, this was through the idea of the Higgs, of the electroweak symmetry breaking mechanism, or the Higgs mechanism, and this is how it works. And then quarks that we saw and charged leptons also get mass from different interactions with the Higgs field. If you paid attention to Niels' first Schrödinger equation, that was the Yukawas, through the Yukawas coupling. He had them there. Now, the mass generation for all these flavors, for all these particles, is still a big mystery. We are trying to solve it and we have measurements, but so far the thing that we have measured for sure at the LHC is that the Higgs is giving mass to the W and the Z bosons, and we are now measuring the couplings, the Yukawa couplings, to the fermions and the quarks in order to say for sure that all these diverse flavors of particles that we have acquire mass through the Higgs. And here come some of the beasts here of what's happening with these quarks and leptons. These quarks and leptons, and we will start with the quarks, they are quantum states, and they seem to be mixing. This is why we call it quantum mixing, quark quantum mixing. And we have discovered how they are mixing. We can put the patterns of the strength of how each one decays to another in a matrix and start making experimental measurements of how, for example, the U will decay to a D And that is a very strong interaction, very strong coupling. And how a U will decay to an S, less strong, and how a U will decay to a B, or a top to a B, all of these are how these particles are actually, these quarks morph from one to another. When they are put together into mesons, they are actually oscillating, so they're changing from one kind of a particle to another kind of a particle. And all of these quantum phenomena can be encapsulated by measuring, by making experiments and measuring these types of strengths. Here I have the strengths, and also there are what we call mixing angles and what we call CP violating phase. This is the zero parameter. The CP violating phase for the quarks, and CP is taking an electron that it is right-handed and transforms it with a charge and the parity, transforms it into a positron, which is left-handed. So what you did with C is you change the charge. What you do with P is you change the handedness. And then nature should be the same, shouldn't care. It's like going backwards in time. The phenomena of the quantum world should not care, except in the weak interactions, and they do. And there is a small violation in the weak interactions that we try to tap on it in order to explain the matter-antimatter asymmetry in the universe, except that one is not enough. This CP violation that we find in the quark sector is not enough. So here is the numbers that we have measured. Here are the numbers that we have measured, and here are a number of experiments. You see in Japan, there was an experiment called Bell, and there is now an experiment that is running called Super Babar. At CERN, there is LHCb, it's running now. There was Babar at SLAC, it finished about 5 years ago. And this was all understanding the quark sector and the mixing, the quantum mixing of the quarks in the standard model, and trying to tap to whether we can understand the matter-antimatter asymmetry. When I keep saying matter-antimatter asymmetry, and you heard it earlier as well, we think that in the beginning there should be about the same matter-antimatter in the universe, in which case everything would have annihilated and we would have an empty universe. So that doesn't stand. So in fact, what is happening is that there is a favorable one part in 10 billions towards matter, so that we end up with a matter universe that we have today. And this is, again, in taking some theoretical assumption and what we observe in the universe. The universe we observe is clearly matter. No matter how you want to shake it, no matter how you want to define matter and antimatter, there's only one of it that we have, and this is matter. So we try in the quark sector to figure out whether this kind of asymmetry can be explained by making the measurements, and we found no. The CP violation, the so-called CP violation that we found in the quark sector, is not nearly enough. However, what happens is that in the lepton sector, there is also quantum mixing, and there's another matrix. And this refers not to all the leptons, but to the neutrinos. And the neutrinos are the little ones, the little neutral ones with the very small masses that have the same type of iffy-wiffy quantum behavior. And there is a matrix that encapsulates again how they are mixing. Now you see neutrinos, and there is neutrino electron neutrino and neutrino one, and I will explain in a minute. The neutrino one is the flavor, and the neutrino electron is the one that is the mixed state of many neutrinos. We go ahead and we measure three mixing angles, and there is one unmeasured, the delta CP phase, which would show us if there was CP violation in the neutrino sector, whether we can understand the matter-antimatter asymmetry of the universe. It's an important endeavor, and it's now the Fermilab US program that is being pursued. So far, we have measured this matrix, and the program was 50 years. It's a 50 years beautiful program on neutrinos. As I said, we know very little about these particles. When the first difference between the prediction of how many solar neutrinos we have from the sun coming to the Earth, there was a first prediction by Bacall, and then Ray Davis measured that, and he found a third less. And so for many years, 10, 20 years, people were thinking that the experimentalist was wrong, or the theorist was wrong, or both were wrong, and they didn't buy it. They didn't buy the measurement that this was the case. Eventually, in 2001, there was here in Canada, at the SNOW experiment at the Sudbury Neutrino Observatory, there was a very definite measurement that actually the solar neutrinos, indeed, there were less coming neutrino electrons. Why? Because they were oscillating. We're going to see that. The intermediate one is from Super K, which is this an experiment in Japan that started measuring. The prime fruit of that experiment was to find whether protons decay, and instead what they found was, again, neutrino oscillations in the atmospheric neutrinos. So I have a few more experiments here that are taking place, in fact, right now. Minos and Nova at Fermilab that are studying this type of phenomena. And I will close on this just to show you a little bit on what happens. The neutrinos from the thermonuclear reactions in the sun, let's say neutrino electrons are being emitted. 8 minutes later, they arrive on Earth. And instead of having only the blue neutrino electrons, we have neutrino electrons, neutrino muons, and neutrino taus. So electron neutrino, muon neutrino, and tau neutrino. Three different kinds of neutrinos have arrived on the Earth. That's why we haven't found all the blue ones. Now, the reason for this is that, in fact, those neutrinos, the electron neutrino, muon neutrino, and tau neutrino, are made of three kind of flavors of little tiny neutrinos with masses, nu1, nu2, and nu3. So they're mixed states. That means that a definite flavor doesn't have a definite mass, and a definite mass, like those three, do not have a definite flavor because they're mixed. And how do you want to think about this? Again, quantum mechanics. It seems quantum mechanics is everywhere, and it is. All of these are oscillating, and then there is an interference pattern that is happening, and one of them, the electron neutrino, is the interference pattern of all of these three. So it depends on you where and when you are going to, depending on when and where you are going to measure it, you are going to see one or the other. So this is very beautiful expression of quantum mechanics, in fact. And this is the planned program that we're going to have a very powerful neutrino beam from Fermilab sent to Stanford Lab, Homestake. It was a gold mine there. We have already one beam that is shooting neutrinos in Minnesota, but this is the next program for high energy physics, for particle physics in the US, and this is the part where CERN is actually investing right now. So I'm going to go back a little bit to remind everybody something about the Higgs, and then I will circle around and connect Higgs with neutrinos, with dark matter, and with what we are doing for the future. Now, we said that the boson that we found was a spin zero boson, a very strange, magnificent new force, shall we say, especially after we measured the self-couplings of the Higgs, which was, of course, predicted in the framework of math. Still for us experimentalists, it wasn't very easy or simple to find it. It took a very long hunt of 30 years and a little more. If I have time in the end, I will show you the milestones from the LHC on a little video. Right at the top, I want to show you. You have seen the picture of the universe with the singularity and the end, and. I am an experimentalist, so the singularities and the ends, I don't know what to say much about. But I can say that if I put on this axis here and try to say where is the first cosmological event in the physics of the universe that I have measured, I would say that it is electroweak symmetry breaking and it is the Higgs boson. Now, we did have some indication for gravitational waves from etc. That would have been before that, but as we found out, it wasn't. So that still remains, the Higgs still remains the first physical phenomenon in the universe that we have experimental evidence, and that's at the 10 to the minus 11 seconds, or it is at the electroweak scale, or it is at the temperature of 10 to the 15 here, on the log 10 to the 15. So this here is where I consider the beginning of the universe, experimentally at least. Now, here is a little clip to show you where the LHC is. It straddles the French-Swiss border. It's close to the... You can see here the one of the two experiments underground. This is the ATLAS experiment. And you will see a time lapse of 4 years of building the calorimeter inside the ATLAS experiment. This is the toroidal magnets. The signatures of all these experiments is how the magnets are designed. This is a large toroidal apparatus, and it has a very large toroidal magnet. It's less strong than CMS. That makes it bigger. That makes the experiment bigger. And it has both experiments, let's say, are dual. You can do the job with both experiments. Here is a little clip of the tunnel. This is in 2007. This was not when all the this is before all the magnets were installed. You see here there is a feed. I want you to note the feed. This is the cryogenic feed. This is helium. There's 9 tons of helium. And we need the helium because we have superconducting magnets that are being in here that operate at 1.9 Kelvin. So it's a pretty spectacular engineering-wise and technology-wise installation, the machine. And the dipole magnets, in fact, the design of the dipole magnets is such that in one magnetic enclosure, you have both beams of protons going the other way. This was discovered at Brookhaven by John Blewett in 1972, but we didn't use it for the SSC. However, the LHC adopted it. This is a transverse view of how particles go through the detector. And what we are seeing here is that we have charged particles leave tracks in the silicon and in the different calorimeters. This is a muon. It left it leaves tracks. It leaves its hints in the tracker and in the muon chambers. Electrons are leaving tracks again in the in silicon, almost silicon cameras, let's say, and then in the electromagnetic calorimeter. And the different other kinds of particles leave their particular signatures in the particular detectors that have to do with nuclear interactions of high energy particles with matter. Now, for those of you who are interested in computer science and machine learning, all of these types, even if you don't know exactly what is happening, all of this now we are putting into different kind of machine learning pattern recognition algorithms, and we are doing the reconstruction in more than one ways. The detectors are both giant detectors. This one is the CMS that I work at. This is a view of the central, so that we can see the superconducting magnet and the calorimeter inside, and then the muon chambers are on the outside. On the first beam, it was September 8th, and Lynn Evans, who was the head of the LHC, commissioning the LHC. This was after a full day of trying to inject beam and have beam collisions, and we did, September 8th. And I was asking him, at this particular moment, I was asking him, what did he think? And he said, let's wait for a few weeks before. And indeed, before we waited for a few weeks, we had the accident at the LHC, where because of the interconnects, because of a soldering issue in the interconnects of the superconducting magnets, we had an explosion. It was an open, so it was a spark, and then an entire set of 40 magnets was affected. We cleaned it out very fast, and we had reserve magnets. So within a year, we were taking the highest energy collisions ever. We had broken the record from the Tevatron, and this was in December of the next year, of 2009. So we recovered pretty fast in terms of the accident. However, the energy was the half energy. So this was the little the L was the Little Hadron Collider. Now we are at the Large Hadron Collider. And I want to say, in terms of the history of particle physics, from the indeed from the from cosmic rays all the way to all the way to Tevatron, LEP, all the other machines that we had in between, we have a very long history. And from 1933 to 1995, with discovery of different particles, this we basically validated and rediscovered the standard model with 9 months of LHC data at 7 TeV. So this was a fit with a high energy machine with very well calibrated detectors. We managed to reproduce all the particle physics of the previous century. Now, this is a picture of Peter Higgs, both at ATLAS and CMS, ATLAS on the left, CMS on the right. And I want to show you here just this plot. It says 09, 11, and then February 27, 2012. And I only want you to see where the whites are, only the white stripes. The white stripes were where the Higgs was allowed to be. In 2009, the x-axis is the mass of the Higgs, and the Higgs was allowed to be only where the white stripes are. And you see how the white stripes are shrinking, because the exclusion region comes from the different experiments and shrinking it, and the remaining was a very tiny slither around 120, above 124, 125, all the way to 130, and then we had the discovery. But this took many decades. This includes Tevatron data, this includes the ATLAS data, the CMS data, and all the constraints from the previous electron-positron collision data, including the SLD ones at SLAC at Stanford. So one thing that I want to say is that at the LHC, we are susceptible to about a petabyte per second. So a petabyte per second is a complex business to deal with. It is more than all the World Wide Web traffic today, and it is the biggest data ever. We talk about big data today with Twitter and Facebook and social media. This is the biggest data ever, and it's also the biggest, smartest data, because we apply triggers in order to keep the data that makes sense. At the Department of Defense, they had this slide where they showed the internet before the LHC. That's in 2008, and they gave it this little pixel on this plot, and now it is this mega highway of transferring data. We are now, I may have a slide on that, but I wanted to say also that we have, in the first 3 years of the LHC data, we have collected 25 petabytes per year, and these are being replicated in many different sites computer-wise in the world. You cannot keep all the LHC data in one single site. There's no data center that can keep all the LHC data. And also, what you couldn't do is you couldn't use the internet, the normal internet in 2008, to do your data, the LHC data transfers and analysis. You would have broken the internet immediately. So the way forward in terms of data, because we are going an order of magnitude, and then for the next version of the LHC we're going to go even higher, is that we have developed gigabit links, transatlantic gigabit links, and collaborating with Internet 2 and all the other providers in order to be able to have smooth and intelligent data placement and data transfers. So the Eureka was announced on July 12. Both experiments put together a publication with their findings, and we immediately got, well, first we got congratulations from the White House, and then from Peter Higgs to both collaboration for his Nobel Prize. I want to show you how the data looked like. Now, in what we're going to see, and this is, you can commit this to memory for the next big discovery, is we have a prediction and we have data. The prediction is our theory. It passed through a simulation of the experiment, and we have data and we compare theory with data. An excess of data in some place, in other words, something that doesn't match the theory within the errors, is a signal for something. In our case here, we had simulation of the something, it was the Higgs, and the simulation here will be red, and it will be at a Higgs at 125 GeV. So now it will run as we are taking data on your left side. We're taking data and we're accumulating more and more data. The little lines represent the errors on the data, and the blue represents the prediction. So now you can see here clearly that we had made a discovery, and it was the Higgs discovery. We found it in other channels as well. This is how the events look like. This is not simulations. This is real events where if you take the invariant mass of these four high energy deposits there, it will give you a Higgs mass. It will give you the Higgs. And similarly, in this case, this was electrons, and this is with four tracks. These are muons. All right, so to say a couple of words on the Higgs connection and continue with closing, in fact, for the Higgs connections, I want to remind everybody or to mention that, in fact, the symmetry breaking mechanism and the Higgs mechanism, therefore, was inspired by condensed matter physics, by phenomena of symmetry breaking in materials. So what material are we talking about when we're talking about electroweak symmetry breaking? Well, it's the vacuum. It's the quantum vacuum. And it's a very complex n-body system, almost, this quantum vacuum. And here is a convergence where ideas from condensed matter physics are applied to particle physics, and they find a fertile ground. This was described in a very beautiful lecture by Nambu, given by Nambu, on the importance of spontaneous symmetry breaking. And in fact, the idea that the quantum vacuum is like a many-body system was proposed, was discussed by Phil Anderson back in the day in a paper that he wrote about more is different, and that spontaneous symmetry breaking is a property of large systems. So, in fact, for the Higgs hunters, there are Higgs hunters in many energy scales, in particle colliders, in condensed matter physics with Bose-Einstein condensates, in superconductors, and in antiferromagnets. And all of these are different forms of the same phenomenon of symmetry breaking. In fact, Peter Littlewood and Chandra Varma had discovered light Higgs type of modes in niobium selenide superconductors in 1981. So Higgs is beautiful, but Higgs needs SUSY. This is the frustration. Before we knew the mass of the Higgs, we had already figured out the story of how we are going to understand the Higgs and its quantum corrections. And that was SUSY. SUSY supersymmetry was coming in to rescue the entire building of Higgs that we had built. And so the natural thing would be to find SUSY immediately or even earlier, before the Higgs. This is what I thought would happen, that we would find the SUSY much earlier than the Higgs, and we would find Higgs in SUSY decays. So supersymmetry, Natalia mentioned before, beautiful. There's nothing here ad hoc. There's no magic in supersymmetry. It's a beautiful last symmetry of space-time. Nothing is ad hoc. It predicts. It has beautiful properties. And the only problem with it is that we haven't found it yet. It would solve immediately the quantum correction issue of the Higgs, and it would be the natural thing to happen right now. In our detectors, we would have to deduce that there is SUSY particles by finding some excess. And the excess in this case is usually excess of missing energy, because the lightest supersymmetric particle that is even weaker interacting than the neutrinos that escape everything. And so these are some displays from ATLAS and CMS that show how SUSY would look like. So if SUSY is the natural fix, then we missed it on 7 or 8 TeV, it means that in a few months from now, immediately, it will show up. It will have to show up, and we will be talking about the discovery of supersymmetry, and the world will change as we know it. And just as a reminder, both the Tevatron and LEP had missed the Higgs just around the corner. So in an article that I wrote with deputy director of Fermilab a year and a half ago, this was called a crisis in physics. The frustration that we haven't found SUSY was called the crisis in physics. In many magazines, it was translated as a crisis in physics, in Italy, in France, in Brazil. However, in Spain, it was translated as más cerca de una nueva física. We are much closer to a new physics. And I think I will take the Spanish approach. Now, beyond the Higgs, we could have, in fact, in supersymmetry, five more Higgses that are different in their masses and in their properties. There is an issue here with the Higgs that gives us pause. Neil mentioned it in the beginning, and I will not spend a lot of time. However, the Higgs, the 126 value, is showing us a borderline disorder in what's happening. Simple, no simple, for me, the consequences are very complex because, for one, we are at the edge of the stability of the universe. That means that the Higgs, if it was different than the actual value than we have by a few GeV in comparison also with the top mass, we could be saying something about the universe, something profound about the universe. Now it's in a metastable condition. It's telling you that the universe may go and find a different lower energy vacuum. With regards to supersymmetry, it's actually on a borderline because it needs more extensions of SUSY. It needs more ad hoc in order to incorporate it. And with respect to heavy other strong dynamics and composite Higgs, it's too light, so it doesn't fit. This mass of the Higgs that we have is it doesn't really fit. And how it connects now with dark matter? Well, you will hear a lot, you heard a lot about dark matter, and you will hear a lot about dark matter here. I'm not going to do a lot on dark matter other than connected with the Higgs. So, of course, you know what is luminous matter. We see it. And dark matter, we don't see it. It's dark. In the cases of how we perceive, how we explain the galaxies that we measure, that we talked about before, that Freddy talked about before, we have in the galaxy, we have stars and gas and dust and a black hole, and then we say we have dark matter. And this dark matter is explaining, essentially, is making an excess gravity. Because without dark matter, Newtonian laws were going to give us a behavior like so, and with dark matter, it would give us like so. And this is what we observe in the data. Here is just the data from all data from Vera Rubin and also some other data that I showed. So this is what we observe. This is with dark matter, or this is what we observe. Now, we observe it gravitationally in other ways by lensing. You know that if you put a lens in front of an image, it can distort the image. And here is a lensing of one galaxy cluster, and it's distorted. All of these lines that you see all around is distortion. Why? Because we think there is a chunk of dark matter in between that distorts the image we get. And if we try to simulate how this dark matter should look, it looks like that. So there is different. There is a topology and the geography of dark matter, and that's what we think. That's what it's needed. However, we don't know what dark matter is, and if it is a particle or if it is something else. It takes 23% of the energy density of the universe, so it's a lot. There is many theories. Most of the theories are giving you particle dark matter, and if it is so, it could be dark matter. This chi here could be connected in collisions at our experiments, either through the Z boson or through the Higgs boson. And so the way we are trying to identify it in our experiments is very, the areas we're trying to identify and the masses that we're trying to identify, it could be, is we are very close to reaching this type of parameter space, and this is why it's exciting to see at the next run how we are going to probe dark matter. There is also, of course, the possibility that there is some other exotic force. And I would say that dark matter is probably the biggest problem in physics today. So with this, let me just... With this, I want to end by saying that in this new run, either we're in the corner of discovering supersymmetry or we need radical new ideas in terms of understanding our universe at this scale. Thank you.
We got time for one quick question.
This one.
Is this on? Very good. Hello, Maria. Jim Gates here.
Hi, Jim.
My question is, so you think we're just around the corner in the discovery of supersymmetry. Are you willing to place a bet about what the maximum number is before people like me should go out to pasture?
What the maximum number? How?
Superpartner mass.
Oh, the mass of the superpartners? If I were to guess, I would place superpartners, different kinds of superpartners at the masses between 400 and 1.6 TeV. In this range, I think we will find something. If it's around the corner, it has to be this range, in fact.
Okay, let's thank Maria again.